Yaptı ki. Why is that not working? Oh, there we go. Okay, Spotlight for everyone.
Hi, Judith. Hi, Elena. How are you?
Baruch Hashem, how are you?
Baruch Hashem, thanks. Is it still cold?
It's getting warmer. We had freezing rain last night.
Oh.
So now it's supposed to be just rain. And that's okay.
I guess what we're expecting, plus 15 Celsius.
Go. It's recording in
Okay.
progress. There we go. Okay. And we should be ready to go. If you can keep your videos on, I can see you all on my screen on my left side, so we're good. And we should be, by my calculation, we finished the story of the Battle of Avshalom and the war with between the two sides of the army and the war with the forest, which is a whole story into itself. And then we went into a discussion on the demise of Avshalom and the burial of Avshalom. I think we are up to actually over here. And the burial of Avshalom and the monument to Avshalom. I think the last thing we did at the end of Shir last week was a discussion of the significance of the name Yad Avshalom and the possible connection to the birth of Shlomo and the naming of Shlomo. I think that's more or less where we got up to. So we're really starting a new section of this story, which is starting with Pasuk Yud-Tet. And there's a number of pieces that we need to pull together, and so we're gonna try to do this in sections. But I want to read through till more or less till the end of the parak and get a sense of what's going on. Va'achimatz ben Sadok amar harutzana va'avasirat amelach ki shifato Hashem miyad oivav. Achimatz son of Sadok said to the king, said to Yoav, "Let me now run and give this report to the king of how God has avenged him of his enemies." Vayomer lo Yoav, lo ish b'sara ata hayom hazeh, uvisarta b'yom acher. Yoav responded and said, "You today, you are not the one who's going to bear this news, who's going to give this report. Your job is another day." This day you will not be the one to bring the news. Ki al ken ben hamelach met, for you to deliver the message that the king's son is dead, no, not going to happen. Yoav lamelach. So Yoav then turned to the Cushite, some kind of right. Remember, there are various geographic and cultural elements within the army of Israel. He has lots of different groups. He has a Hittite element, and he has various different. We talked about Yahiti, we talked about Itai Giti. So, amongst his servants, he has from Eretz Kush as well. Eretz Kush in Tanakh is everything south of Egypt, is Eretz Kush. So, Kushi lech hagid lamelach, you go and tell the king what you have seen. So the Cushi bowed to the king and to Yoav, and he ran to go report to David. Just as a FYI, as an aside, who is Achimatz ben Sadok? Name should be familiar. Who is Achimatz ben Sadok?
I don't remember. Find
Yeah,
us.
we've had him. Tzadok HaKohen, Evyatar HaKohen, Achimatz. This is Yehotz ben Tzadok and
Here.
Yonatan ben Evyatar. Who are Achimatz and Yonatan?
Yes, she did.
Those are the Kohanim that he sent back.
Correct. So the father, Tzadok and Evyatar, the two Kohanim that he sent back with the Aron to Yerushalayim.
Right.
Their sons were his spies. The sons of Achimatz and Yonatan were there back in Perek. What Perek was that? Perek.
Oh, there.
Yeah. והנה גם צדוק וכל הלוויים איתו נושאים את ארון ברית האלוקים, הציקו את ארון האלוקים. צדוק was the primary Kohen at the time, together with Eviatar, they brought the Aaron, and the king said to them, Hashev et Aaron Elokim ha'ir, take the Aaron back to Yerushalayim. And ויאמר המלך על צדוק הכהן, הרואה אתה שוב העיר בשלום, אחימץ בנך ויהונתן בן אביתר, שני בניכם איתכם, you have two sons, אחימץ and יונתן, between you, צדוק, and אביתר, your sons, right, cousins, your sons are both Kohanim. I'm not sure the relationship between Achimatz and Eviatar, but nonetheless, between Tzadok and Eviatar. But the two sons, Achimatz and Yehonatan, they were the ones who would report to David. They could come and go. They were the ones who gave David warning of the impending plan of Achitophel and Avshalom. That is, they are there in the palace. And so Achimatz was, and Yehonatan were the two who came and who reported to David when it all began. And now Achimatz, who's obviously in the battle, he turns to Yoav and says, okay, now I would like to go be the one to tell the king of the victory of his enemies and how God has avenged him of his enemies. And Yoav said to him, not today. This news includes the death of Avshalom. You are not going to bear this news to the king. So he turns to a non-entity. This Cushi is unidentified by name. He's just one of the servants of the army of Israel. And he says, Lech haged lemelech asher ra'ita, v'yishtachu Cushi liyoav ha'yarotz. V'yosef od achimatz ben tzadok v'yomar el yoav, v'hi ma rutsa nagam ani achrei ha'kushi. So Achimatz said to Tzadok, I also want to go. I want to go run. I'll go, also want to go report to the king. I'll follow him. I'll run after the Cushi. I'll catch up to him. And Vihima, whatever could come of it, I want to be the one to report to the king. Vayomer Yoav, lama ze ata ratz bini? Why are you running, my son? Ulecha en b'sura motzet. You will have no success, reward, achievement, whatever this word is. This report, this that you seek, will be of no avail to you. The Imarutz, says Achimatz, whatever, come with me. I want to run. I want to go. So finally, Yoav says, Yomar lo, Rutz, fine. You want to go? Go. The Yarutz Achimatz derech hakikar v'yavor et hakushi. Achimatz ran, but Achimatz was a little smarter than the average chayal, and he, instead of running straight through the forest and over the hills and under dale, as the expression goes, and try to get to David, Achimatz ran to the kikar, to the plains, meaning down to the Yarden, and he ran over straight ground, which enabled him to, even though he could, the Cushi had a head start, enabled him to pass the avor at the Cushi, to run and overrun the Cushi, meaning to arrive first. The David Yoshev ben Shnei Hasha'arim, David was sitting between the two gates. Vayelech hatsofe el gag hashar el hachoma. The watchman went up to the roof of the gate of the wall. Vayisat einav hayar v'nei ish ratz levado. Lifted up his eyes and he saw a man running towards him. ויאמר המלך, ויגיד, where was I? ויסד ויאר הנה איש רץ לבדו. And this man was running by himself. ויקרא הצופה ויגיד למלך, so the watchman called down, and he said to the king, ויאמר המלך, אם לבדו בשורה בפיו. If he is in fact alone, then there is news in his mouth, meaning that he's coming with the report. ויאלך הלוך וקרף. And he began to approach. And then the watchman saw, looked out, and he saw another man running. So he turned down, he called down to the gate watchman, and he said to him, go report to the king. There's another man running. Gamzemavaser. This one's also coming to bring news. Just a technicality. Why is it significant that they're by themselves? What if they weren't by themselves? What if there was an entourage of 10 people, of 15 people, of 50 people coming? Why does he report that he's in Eish Ratz Levado?
If there were more, they would think they would come to attack them.
Either they were coming to attack, it's a possibility, or they knew that they were coming to report, or that they were coming as kind of running, coming from the war. If 50, 100, 150 people are coming from the direction of the battlefield, then the likelihood might be greater that they are, in fact, not reporting on the condition of the war, but actually retreating from the battle to the king. So essentially, when the people return from the front, they can either come in mass because they are victorious. That's a march. That's a parade of victory. We'll talk about that another time. Or they can come because they're running, right? They're retreating. Or they can come by themselves. And if they're coming by themselves, the likelihood is greater that they're coming to give a report. And that's exactly what David says to the watchman. He says, "Im levado, if he's coming by himself, then besorah b'fiv, he's coming to report something. So that's okay. Then you can let him in. Then there's another one coming to report. So that already got gets suspicious. And the king said, no, come zemabaser. That's also not we haven't reached the threshold of suspicion yet. Then he's reporting a third time. And this time they're coming closer, right? So we can imagine the scene. Right? The watchman's on the top of the tower. David is down below. He's looking out into the field and he's seeing this man coming. We'll talk about the geography, the structures here in a second. Vayomer HaTzofer, ani ro'eh et merutzat harishon ki merutzat Achimatz ben Tzadok. I see the first one running. He looks like he's Achimatz, son of Tzadok, meaning, and this is not uncommon. We all do this intuitively. You see somebody in the distance, walking, running, walking outside, and you see somebody very far away. You can't see their face. You can't recognize who they are. But just by the way they walk, by the way they stand, by the way they conduct themselves, you can very often recognize a person. If you know them well enough, you can recognize by the way they walk, by the way they hold themselves, by the way they look, right? So this watchman is looking out, and he sees a man running, and he says, oh, I recognize that walk, that run. I recognize that person. He looks like he is Achimatz ben Tzadok. Vayomer HaMelech, oh, ish tov ze, vel besorah tova yavo. Oh, he's a good man. He must be coming to give a good report. Okay, how that connects, we'll see. Vayikra Achimatz, so Achimatz approaches. Vayomer HaMelech, shalom. He says to the king, all is well. Vayishtachu lefanav. He falls and bows down to the king, and he says, Baruch Hashem Elokecha Asher Sigar Et HaAnashim Asher Nasu Et Yadam B'Adoni HaMelech. Blessed is Hashem who has delivered the men that lifted their hands up against the king. God has delivered them into your hands. Vayomer HaMelech, we did not read these verses last week, right? No. Vayomer HaMelech, Shalom la na'ar la Avshalom. Is it well with Avshalom? Vayomer Achimatz, ra'iti ha'amon ha'gadol lishloach et Eved HaMelech Yoav et Avdecha v'lo yedati ma. I don't understand that pasuk at all. Right? It's just the grammar of that verse makes no sense whatsoever. The only way to make any heads or tails out of that sentence is to rearrange it. So if I rearrange it, it would read as, at the time that Yoav sent the Cushi and myself, Lishloach et Eved HaMelech Yoav et Avdecha, when Yoav wanted to send Eved HaMelech, referring to the Cushi, and Avdecha, referring to himself, at that moment, Re'iti HaHamon, I saw a tumult, V'lo Yadati Ma, I didn't understand what it was about. That's essentially how they translated it here, but to do that, you have to do a lot of rearranging of the words in the sentence because the sentence itself is a jumble that makes no sense at all. And essentially, how does Achimatz answer the question of what is the state of my son Avshalom? How does he answer it?
He doesn't answer.
He doesn't. He does not answer it at all. He gets tongue-tied, tongue-twisted. He mumbles and jumbles and unintelligible grammar. He gets very confused and confounded, and he says nothing. David is not a stupid king. Vayomer HaMelech. So Yitzev Kol, he knows that there's another messenger coming behind him. So he says to Achimatz, fine, you go stand over here. Vayisov Vayamod, Achimatz goes and stands off to the side. Vinei HaKushiba. Oh, now the Kushi comes. Vayomer HaKushi, Yitbaser Adoni HaMelech, I have news for the king. God has avenged you this day of all those who rose up against you. And the king says to the Cushi, and what of my son Avshalom? To which he answers, Yehi kana'ar oyve adoni amelech v'chol asher alecha kamu alecha l'ra'a. May your enemies who rise up against you all meet the same fate as that na'ar. Okay. I think David got the message. Next verse reads, Vayirgaz hamelech, the king was very moved, meaning very distressed. He goes up to the room over the gate. We'll talk about that in a moment. He cried, and he began to weep and to go and to mourn and to lament. And he would cry out, "Bini Avshalom, bini, bini Avshalom, my son Avshalom, my son, my son. Mi yiten muti ani tachtecha Avshalom, bini, bini. Would that I could have died in your stead, Avshalom, my son." And he'll say it again later on. Bini Avshalom, Avshalom, Bini, Bini. All right, let's go back. That's the story. And there's a lot to unpack here because there's a lot of variables, including this whole half a chapter deals essentially with one primary question, which is, who is going to be the one to report to the king? Achimatz wants to. Yoav doesn't want to let him. Yoav and Achimatz have an argument. Yoav says to the Cushi, "You go and do it." Achimatz pushes and he says, "I want to do it anyway." Yoav says to him, "I don't want you to go. It won't be good. You don't need. This is not for you. This is for the Cushi." Achimatz pushes again. Finally, Yoav says, "All right, you know what? You want to run? Run. Go tell the king." So Achimatz, oh, he's got permission to go and tell the king. He's going to run ahead of the pack. So he runs ahead of the pack. He passes the Cushi, and he gets to the palace, and he finally comes to the king to report to the king, and he gets tongue-tied. Doesn't know what to say. And he starts with all kinds of words that I'll show you an interesting observation. We're going to deal with all of this next week. Most of this we're going to deal with next week. Tonight I want to get to a different part of the picture, but I just want to show you one observation. When Achimatz first comes to Yoav, remember it's Achimatz who offers his service, and he says to David, sorry, he says to Yoav, "I want to report to the king." What is the message he wants to deliver to David? It's very simple. Kishvato Hashem miyad oivav. God has shafat, judged or avenged you of his of your enemies. Meaning, God has given you victory over your enemies. Simple report, correct? And then there's this whole conversation of whether he's going to go, the other guy's going to go, back and forth. When Achimatz finally shows up in David's palace. Actually, I'm going to do this on two screens because it'll be easier to see this if I keep this here. So let's do this. When Achimaaz shows, this is the same chapter. I've just got it on two tabs. Everybody seeing when I jump back and forth? Okay. When Achimaaz shows up, remember he comes first, and he reports to the king. And he says to the king, Vayomer, Baruch Hashem Elokecha, blessed is God, asher sigar ha'atanashim asher nasu et yadam ba'adoni ha'melech. Blessed is God who's delivered up the men that lifted up their hands against my lord the king. Is this message the same as the message Achimaaz initially offered to report to the king? Okay, so I'm going to put them side by side. This is, well, sort of side by side. I'm just going to jump. This is the original message. Kishvato Hashem miyad oivav. God has judged, avenged David of his enemies. And this is God has delivered up the men that lifted up their hands against the king. Is there a difference between those two expressions? I probably wouldn't ask the question if they didn't think there was. So that's already a good hint. But what's the subtlety in that language? What's the difference between sigarat anashim, delivered up the men, versus shvato Hashem biyad? Right? Shvato Hashem biyad levav. God has avenged David of his enemies. I think to note that God has avenged him of his enemies is a way of saying we were victorious, period. We beat them, we killed them, we destroyed them, they're gone. Kishvato Hashem miyad oivav. Correct? What Achimaaz reports is not the same. It's more complex. God has delivered them. Delivered them where? Delivered them to whom? Are they dead? Are they captured? Are they in jail? Are they right? Are they extra? Are they ex? Are they Sagaralim is a are they extradited to wherever they came from? What is Sigar HaTanashim? He delivered the men. Right? It's a very different expression than Shvato Hashem. God has judged, God has avenged you of your enemies. You hear the difference? Now that might be insignificant. It might be the same thing, except that when David responds and says, okay, so where's Avshalom? Achimaaz gets totally tongue-tied. Ra'iti et ha'amon, nishloach et ha'eben ha'melech, yu'av et avtecha, v'lo yadati, ma, the tumult, I didn't understand, I didn't know, I just left, Noah sent me, I left, I didn't understand what was going on. I didn't understand how to articulate a sentence either, but that's a separate issue. Right? It is totally tongue-tied. Then the Cushi showed up. And the Cushi had a simple message for him. What was the Cushi's message? Here, Pasuk Lamed Aleph. The Cushi's message to David is, Kishvatcha Hashem ayom miyad kol hakamim alecha, God has avenged you of all those who have risen up against you. Sound familiar? Right, that's exactly what Achimaaz had suggested initially should be the message to David. Who delivered the message? Simple, straight, clear, unambiguous? The Cushi. Achimaaz got tongue-tied. So something's going on in this story, and we need to unravel what it is and what the issue is. And of course, there's the story of the Avshalom and how that fits in, and Yoav, and why Yoav wants to let one run go and not the other, and he turns his back and he says, "No, you're not going to go. I'll let this guy go." Achimaaz insists. Well, who cares who got there first? And a lot of very strange pieces of this story that we need to sort out. Clear? We're all good? Okay. None of that we're going to sort out. Yeah.
Right?
Go ahead.
I just said he knew he might shoot the messenger, but that's not really what David does, generally.
No, right? David has shot the messenger in the past, but we'll get to that piece of it. It's not the shame. Next week, but I don't know that that is what's driving him here. We'll see. That's an interesting question. Whether that what's driving him is he's afraid for his life because David might harm him, or some other agenda. It's a good point. David has what we need to do is first of all understand what the role of the messenger is, and when we've seen him before, what role he plays, and we're going to come to that. We may even have time to come to that today. We'll see. But for now, what I want to do is park all of this. That's sort of the introduction to this chapter. And what I'd love to do is do something I rarely do, but it's just too tempting to let it go here. And that is that there's a series of references here that are an archaeologist's dream. In other words, references to structures are what the bread and butter of biblical archaeology is about. And biblical archaeology doesn't deal with conversations, it deals with structures. You want to talk about a structure. You want to talk about a gate and a house and an attic and a double gate and a single gate and a right. Yeah, suddenly we're into structures. Oh, that can have a field day with that. So the truth is that what we have in this story is a reference to some structures that the text takes for granted, but they're actually very significant. So, for example, when the when Achimatz and the Cushi run to David, they both come. I'm starting with Pasuk of Dalet. We find the following pasuk: "V'David yoshev ben shnei ha'she'arim." David sat between the two gates. Vayelech hatzofe el gag hasha'ar el hachoma. The watchman went up to the roof of the gate, to the wall of the gate, to the wall or the gate of the wall. Or he went up to the roof of the gate, meaning he went up to the top of the wall. However you read it, doesn't matter. It comes to the same thing. Vayisa'at He lifted up his eyes and he saw somebody coming to him. So up there's this watchman called the Tzofeh, and he's at the top of the gate or the top of the wall that sits at the edge of two walls or two gates, and David is sitting between the two gates or between the two walls. And the Tzofeh calls down to him, and he responds. So obviously they're within earshot of each other. And then the Sofer continues to say he sees somebody else coming, and that's and David says this is also good news. And they come to David into the Sha'ar. And then we have what do we have so far? We have two Sha'arim, we have two gates, we have a Choma, we have a wall, we have a place for the Sofer, a place for the watchman, a place for the Melech. Can't just be a random, he's not standing at the base of the tower waiting for the king to waiting for the watchman to talk to him. He's got some position or some place to be. And then in the beginning of the next chapter, we have Vayal el Aliyat HaShaar. When David gets all distressed, he goes up to the room over the gate. What's the Aliyat HaShaar? And how does it differ from the So what do I have? I have just to sorry, I was in the wrong text, but it's fine. Same place. All right. So what do I have? I have the Sha'ar. I have two Sha'arim actually. I have the Gag Hasha'ar. I have the roof of the gate. I have where the Tzofeh sits. I have a place for the king, and I have an Aliyah for the Sha'ar. I have some sort of a room on top of the gate. I have a lot of structures here. Right? So fascinatingly, a recent archaeological kind of, recent, in the last number of decades, there's been a lot of work in, or a century, I would say, there's been a lot of work in terms of uncovering the structures of walled cities in of the biblical era, particularly the largest of the archaeological digs that have uncovered the gates of the city. In a walled city of significant proportions, is the city of Lachish. Tel Lachish is probably one of the largest of these archaeological discoveries. Anybody ever been to the So what I sh wanted to share with you is the fact that this was very common in the biblical era, really the time period of Shlomo, all the way through till the end of Malchut Yisrael. We have what was referred to as the archaeological structure of the gates of the city, the city gates. And there are many of these archaeological digs. There are many of these places where they have found these kinds of structured gates. And the gate here is not what we refer to as a gate. When you open up a latch and you twist and you open the gate, you walk through. We're talking about Shar Yafo. Think Shar Yafo. We talk about a gate of a wall city. We're talking about a major wall with an opening that you, right, an access way through that wall. That's called a gate. That's called Shar. That's what a shahr is. So the walls of the old city were built many, many years later. They are they're built by the Ottomans, but the concept, I think, is similar. So you want to get a sense of what it looks like. Just think in your mind something like Shar Yafo. Okay, big walls, wide walls, open space. You walk through it, and there's a courtyard behind it. Right, that's more or less what you have to think in your minds of what we're talking about. And there were a number of these archaeological digs and discoveries in this particular website, which kind of reviews all of them. It's called the Explore Abrahamic History and Archaeology. Okay, just an interesting website. Goes through, whoops, I hate these ads. And I'm jumping to the bottom for a minute just to see. There are a number of them. We're going to get to all these pictures in a second, but they are, you know what? Let's do it this way. I've collected all of these little various pieces and put them here into the source page, which I will share with you. But there are a number of these structures. One of them is Tel Megiddo, another one of these structures, Gezer, Megiddo, Chatzor. Right, and now, of course, at Lachish, which is the largest of these archaeological discoveries and archaeological digs in Israel today. What's the Chachma? The Chachma is that this was the normal procedure by which walled cities were built, with a fortification embedded into the structure of the wall. And remember that David is not in Lachish, of course. David is in Machanaim on the other side of the Yarden, right? David is near the Yar Ephraim, but he's not sitting in an open field, right? He's sitting in a city that was a major center. The kings were anointed in Machanaim. Ishbosheth was anointed in Machanaim. David runs to Machanaim. Right? Machanaim was not a small place. And so we can kind of get a sense of what was the typical archaeological structure of the gates of the city from this story. So Tel Lachish today is now exposed, and it's 13 feet high, consists of six chambers measuring some 80 by 80 feet in total. The gate of Tel Lachish is one of the largest in Israel, dating from the First Temple period, the temple built named for the temple built by Jerusalem in Jerusalem by King Solomon. Tel Lachish gate is a well-preserved example of a city gate from this period. And that's the key piece that I wanted to pull from here. The size of the gate consistent with historical and archaeological knowledge. Fine. What is the significance here? According to the biblical narrative, the gate would have been right at the heart of the city's most important activities. Meaning, the gate, what we call a shaar as an entranceway, in Tanakh, and in Chumash, a shaar is much more than an entranceway. It's the center of all activity for the city. It's the center of commerce for the city was in the shaar. The courts of the community, of the city, were placed in the shaar. It's a pasuk in the beginning of Shoftim. Shoftim v'shotrim titen lecha b'chol sha'arecha. Right? Courts and officers you shall place in all of your gates. There is the idea that when Mordechai is described as being involved in the palace affairs, he overhears the conversation between Bigtan and Teresh. She's probably part of the court activities that adjudicated in the case of Bigtan and Teresh's assassination attempt on Achashverosh's life. The pasuk says, "V'Mordechai Yoshev b'Sha'ar HaMelech." Mordechai was sitting in the gate of the king. You have another reference in Daniel, similarly, that Daniel betra Malka, he's sitting in the gate of the king. So the gates was much more than just a open passageway. It was the heart of the city's most important activities, the courts, the chain, the commerce, the sha'ar, which is where you would, when we talk about, in modern Hebrew, we talk about stock market rates. Right? What do we call the rate of the what do they call it? The rate of exchange, currency rate of exchange in modern Hebrew is called the sha'ar. Right? Sha'yitzig. Right? The rate of exchange is called the sha'ar of any particular currency, because all currency, all activity took place, commerce, the market was inside this place called the sha'ar. So obviously, we're not talking about a structure with a gate, right? We're talking about something which is much more significant. And the first thing we need to recognize is that there are, in fact, two gates. There's an outer gate, and there's an inner gate. And in between them, there's a central plaza. Right? What did the pasuk say about David? That there was a David was sitting. What is the pasuk? But David Yoshev ben Shnei HaShe'arim, sitting between the two gates. In fact, I think, in fact, if I look at the Radak, I think Radak actually says this, Shehayah le'ir choma lifnim michoma. The city, the wall had a wall within a wall. Well, the city had a wall within a wall. V'sha'ar lifnim mishar, and therefore a gate or an entrance through the outer wall and an entrance through the inner wall. U'ben shnei ha'sha'arim haya makom ha'yeshiva, and the king sat in between these two gates. Whatever that means, we'll see in a second, as it says, El Yad ha'sha'ar. He was sitting near the gate. Think for a moment of Rachav, the Beit Rachav HaZonah, in the story of Yehoshua, by when Yehoshua sends the spies. Right? And they come to the house of Rachav. And where was Rachav's house? Right? Between the two walls of the city, so that she has to ask for special permission so that her house should be spared when the walls fall. Right? So I always had this vision as a child of these two walls like this, and this little tiny house in the middle that was sort of sandwiched in between the two walls, because Nebuchadnezzar, that's where she decided to build her house, in between the two walls. But it's much more complex than that. Her house was at the center of the city. It was in the entrance. It was a hotel, right? That's what a Beit Zonah was. It wasn't a harlot house. It was a place of mazon. It was a hotel. And where do you put the hotel? You put a hotel where the activity of the city is. The activity of the city is ben shnei hachomot, is between the two walls of the city, between the two sha'arim. That's exactly what you have. All biblical cities, that's sort of the pattern. And that is what you have here. That's where the commerce was, and therefore that's where the courts were. That's where the courts were, because where do you put the court? You put the court near your center of commerce. Right? Two people have an argument in the middle of a business transaction. Where are they going to go? They're going to go to the court. They're not going to go across town. The courts are right there. That's where they put all of these different structures, in this same place. That's how they built the cities. So the outer gate, we'll see these pictures in a second, associated with the western flank of the Tell, was the only access to the fortified city. Access to the gate via a somewhat steep path, we'll see that in a second. The central plaza was in between, which is where day-to-day business took place. Not only commerce, but although there were these sections where all the government officials presided there, and the kings sat there. The government offices and a marketplace and security area and commonplace gathering for the public, and all of these different chambers that all sat in this central plaza. And then you have the inner gate, which was also discovered, and these inner gates, southern chambers, partially reconstructed. Governors, judges, city elders, other officials would sit in these in this area. Okay, so let us what do we have here? So here's a picture of what exists today in Tel Lachish, and this is the location of what we refer to as the outer gate, and here is the location of what we refer to as the inner gate. And they also have, I don't see if you see it in this structure here, but you also have all of these in very common, these little structured areas inside the plaza. So this is an artist's rendition, more or less, of what this structure might have looked like if you put everything back. And here you have a very good example of exactly what we're talking about. Actually, I'm going to scroll out for 1 second so you see both pictures together. Very good example of what we're talking about. This is your entrance to the outer gate of the city. Right? So here you're coming up the path. And as you enter into the outer gate, you have a gate, you have watchtowers, and you have a large plaza in between with lots of little chambers for either business or commerce, or in much later period of history, think about the Cardo and the various stalls that they built there. So this is a big open area. And then you have also places like that are described down here, are these little chambers where you have, this is from Megiddo, a similar kind of structure. You have an outer gate and an inner gate, and then you have a big courtyard in the middle where people could come and engage in commerce, etc. There's a logic to having a dual structured or two layered structure. Somebody, for example, who lives in this city, who wants to engage in commerce, right? Say he has wares to sell. Where's he going to sell his wares? In a place where the public can access it. But you don't want the public coming into your city because you defeats the whole purpose of having a wall. So your public access is to the inner courtyard, which sits between the outer wall and the inner wall. And there are all the people from all of the around the neighboring areas and villages. They can come, they can sell their wares, they can buy their wares, they can engage in commerce. This is the center of the city. And if there's an adjudication that needs to be made, shoftim mishoftim titen lecha, that's where your courts sat, that's where the king sat. He was the head of the courts, right? That's where your army would have its march victory parade if it came traipsing through. That's the courtyard, that's the plaza. And then behind it sits the inner shire or the inner gate of the city, and that has access to the city itself. But your public doesn't go there, right? The whole purpose of having this plaza is so that everything that's taking place from the people who are coming to visit takes place here before they can breach the inner security of that layer. So it's having like a two-layer, sort of like having two-factor verification, right? It's having two layers of security on your building, on your structure, by allowing all of the commerce to take place here in the outside. And then you have, so that's very common. That sort of, we're talking about Lachish, which is built in the time of Shlomo HaMelech. We're not that far behind it now in time of David. And this, you have Tel Megiddo, a similar kind of structure. And all of these turrets are kind of an artistic rendition of what would be where the watchmen would sit, and not hard to imagine these little chambers here where the king might have a residence in that moment, or temporary or otherwise. And so when David goes to mourn, he goes up to one of these aliyot, he goes up to the roof of the or the attic or the room above the shire, and there he's crying and lamenting and mourning for his son. I can just see it in this kind of structure. It gives you a very visual picture of what would have been the context of the city of Mechanaim, similar on a much smaller scale. And you have this description. So David Yoshev ben Shnei HaShe'arim, he's sitting between the two walls. The Tzofeh is sitting on the Gag HaShar, on the roof of the Shar. So David is sitting somewhere in this inner courtyard. And the Tzofeh is sitting here somewhere in the court of the Gag HaShar. And then, and he has this whole conversation between the Tzofeh and David. And when he's done, and he realizes in the end that David, in fact, that Avshalom has been killed, he goes up to, sorry, I didn't mean to do that. He goes up to Aliyat HaShar, to the rooftop, to the room. And there he has this communication. And there he has this moment to mourn for his son. So, and I share that with you. It's not really a chiddush here. It's just, I think it's just a fascinating way of looking at this parak, because not always we have a very clear structure in archaeology that matches what we're reading in the text. And this is one of those places where suddenly you have like this all of these structures are here. It tells us what biblical cities in the Shire looked like, a whole insight into the world of fortified walled cities at that time. Okay, questions on that? We're good?
Why is the king sitting so publicly?
Why wouldn't he? Why wouldn't him? The king is the king. He's part of the people. He sent his army off to battle. Where else is he going to sit except somewhere accessible where he can hear the reports of what's going on with his soldiers? And David normally would be in the battlefield, and he would normally be out with his troops. It's not like in the Crusader times where the kings and the popes are hidden and nobody has access to them. Right? The king was part of his people. He went out with his people into war, and in this particular case, he didn't. But he was certainly sitting in a place where he would be able to hear or see a report, and that's exactly what you have. The Tzofeh is the lookout. And I suspect if the Tzofeh saw a threat coming, he would tell the, they would do something to avoid the threat for the king. But this is your Tzofeh is your first line of defense visually. Okay, so here you have to get, the only way into the city is through this road, but behind it is where the king is sitting. So that I think actually makes a lot of sense. Okay, we're good on that front? Okay.
Yeah, when he's screaming up at the top of the tower, probably a lot of people heard him.
Yeah, I don't know how sure the screaming will that I don't know. I don't know how the communication system works in those days. what it tells us is that they communicated. Were they screaming at each other, or were they sending runners back and forth, or were they? I don't know. That
when he got upset about Avshalom, he cried.
Say that again.
I'm saying when he cried about Avshalom.
That
I'm just saying,
very,
like everyone
that was
knew.
Very public. That was very public. Everybody knew that he was crying about Avshalom. I don't know if they knew what he was saying, but they certainly knew. And if they came to visit him, they came to see him. He was certainly, that was certainly, And we'll talk about that. We'll get to that part of the story. The other thing I wanted to point out, let's go back to Perek Yudchet for a moment. I actually want to do something else. Close this. Here's an interesting. I meant to prepare this before the class. One of the things I like about this website is that you can do all kinds of fun things with it. Let me ask you another question. Let's go back to the conversation between Achimatz and Yoav. Let's go back to the beginning of the story, which is Pasuk Yutet. There's a series of conversations going on. There's Achimatz and Yoav. There's Yoav and the Cushi. Then there's Achimatz and Yoav again. Right? And finally, Achimatz begins his run to the palace, or to David. Then he gets to David, and the Tzofeh sees him. So now there's a conversation between the Tzofeh and David twice. And then there's a conversation between David and Achimatz and David and the Cushi. Correct? There's a whole bunch of different conversations going on. I would venture to argue that there's one word that kind of flows through all the conversations. And in Tanakh terminology, or the study of Tanakh terminology, we would call that a milat mancha, a key word, a guiding word, a word that is critical to understanding the nature of this chapter and the story itself. So what word is navigating through this chapter from beginning to end, beyond the prepositions and verbs, right? Not ayom or azeh, right? Significant words navigating through this chapter as from Achimatz, name of Achim, right? Besides names and places, right? But a word that actually has significance in terms of the story. Excuse me?
Bear the news.
To bear the news. What does to bear the news mean? So let's take a look. Here's an interesting way of doing this. We could do it by counting words, but I like to play with this this little tool. So we're going to look at this chapter here. This is an online tool that allows you to take any chapter in Tanakh and begin to look for word patterns. Okay? So word patterns, if I start with Pasuk Yotet, and I can hover over any word and see how many times that word appears. Just an interesting way of playing with words. So if I take out things like names, like Achimatz and the Kushi and David and the Yoav, I take out the names, I take out other prepositions, and I start to look for words that pop up a lot in the Hebrew. And the first word that's going to pop up, it's going to jump off the page for me, is this word here, which is Besorah. Okay?
Besorah
means a message, a news, right? And if I add it to that, if I continue to take, again, I take out the prepositions like Ela and Kushi and etc., and I add the verb of Besorah, the verb of Besorah is Livsor, Avasra, Ubisarta, okay? So if I add the verb, so now between the verb and the noun, now I have Va'avasrata Melech. Achimat says to the king, to Yoav, I want to inform the king. Yoav says, Lo ish bisora'ata, you are not a man, you are not going to be the bearer of this news today. Uvisarta biyom acher, you will bear that news, you will carry that news a different day. V'ayom ezeh lo tevaser, today you will not be the one to bring the news. Ki al kein ben ha-melech met, because the king's son has died. Then he turns to the Kushi and he says, you go and tell the king what you saw. Then Achimatz insists, and he says, I want to go anyway. V'hi ma'arutza nagam ani. V'yomar Yoav, lam ezeh ratz b'ni, lecha en b'sora motzet. If you are not going to find any benefit in this message that you are going to bring, meaning there's no payment here. He's not going to pay you for your efforts. V'yomarutz, he wants to go anyway, so he runs, and he advances past the Kushi, and v'yikra tzofe v'ged l'melech, he calls to the tzofe, is now seeing Achimatz run to the palace, run to the king, v'yaged l'melech v'yomer ha'melech, im levado, if he's by himself, then b'sora b'fif, then he has some kind of message in his mouth. Let him come. And then there's another one coming, and he says to the tzofeh says there's a second person running, in the ish ratz levado, and the man, and the king again says, gamzeh mevaser. The other one was a mevaser. This is also a mevaser. Then the tzofeh comes, and he says, I see the first one, he looks like Achimatz ben Tzadok, says David, ish tov zeh, ve'el bisorah tova yavo. It's a good man. He's going to come and bring good tidings, good news, good bearing. Then Achimatz comes, and Achimatz gets tongue-tied, and he gets all flabbergasted, and he has this conversation with David, which does not go well. We'll talk about that next week. And Melech David says to him, "You stand over there. I don't want to talk to you anymore." Kushi comes in. Vayomer haKushi. The Kushi says, "Yitbaser Adoni Melech. News for the king." So between these two references, between the verb and the noun, I have nine references to the word besor, besorah, mevaser. Clearly, this is a word that is not tangential, accidental, but that is central to the motif of this parak. One of the ways in which we discover these kinds of things, I think it's intuitive as we read it through, as you, I think, correctly pointed out, But when you kind of process it through this, what is called the Tanakh engine, then it becomes even more it becomes even clearer. The question is, why is that the key word? What is going on here? And it's not the first time we've encountered this word or this idea that the person coming from the battlefield who comes and brings a message that is a message about the war, a message about the effort, a message about the campaign, a message about what's going on. Litov, besorah tovah, right? It could be a good report or not. It could be a besorah tovah or it could be a besorah lo tovah, right? Depends on the context. But that it is a significant position that we have seen before. And I'll show you a couple of examples to see right away where we have seen it in the past. Very powerful stories. Let's go to, let's go for back to the very beginning. Let's go to Shmuel Aleph, Perek Dalet. Anybody remember Shmuel Aleph, Perek Dalet? I'll start to tell you the story, you'll remember. But that was when we talked about Eli and Chafni and Pinchas and the fall of Shiloh and the Ark getting captured by the Philistines and the Ark going into the land of and coming back to Beit Shemesh. And they opened up the Ark and they looked at it and 50,000 Beit Shemeshites died. Right. Now the story is familiar, right? More familiar. Anyway, there is a moment there where this is all in fulfillment of, right, this is the battle of with the Plishtim called Ebenezer, where Shiloh falls. They come up to Shiloh and Shiloh is destroyed. Shiloh, the Mishkan in Shiloh is destroyed, very much as a punishment for the sins of Eli and his sons, Chafni and Pinchas. And the Ark is captured by the Philistines and taken down to Eretz Plishtim. So now the Ark is now in captivity in the displayed in the in the temples of the Philistines down in Gat and the various cities of the Plishtim. That's all the beginning of chapter 4. And amongst the events of that chapter is when they take the ark, those who carried the ark were the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Pinchas. They died in that battle. They were killed by the Plishtim. And all of that in anticipation of the fulfillment of the prophecy by the Isha Elohim, the Navi, to Eli for the sins of his family. But go to the end of this parak. Let's start from Pasuk Yud Bet. The Ark of God was taken, the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Pinchas, were slain, and thousands were killed. And the battle was a terrible defeat. 30,000 people died in that battle from the soldiers of Israel, and the Churban was of Shiloh, and the Kohanim were destroyed, and the Mishkan was burnt. It was a terrible, terrible destruction. I've often said that the events of the fall of Shiloh kind of get glossed over because they're not in Sefer Shmuel. Many of them are in Sefer Tehillim. But it's really the first Tisha B'Av, the Mishkan that had stood for close to 400 years, 370 years in Shiloh, was destroyed by the Plishtim. More or less, it was the first type of Tisha B'Av that we encountered. Vayarotz ish mi binyamin mehamaracha. There was a man who ran from the army, left the field. And he comes to Shiloh, which is where the Mishkan was, where Eli was. Umadav kruim, his clothes, his uniform, was torn. Va'adama avosho, and earth, ashes upon his head. So if you see a runner from the field coming to report, and he has earth upon his head and his clothes rent, what does that describe somebody? What does that tell you about the battle?
Not going very well.
Not going very well, right? This is not a good news. This is not a bearer of good news.
Right.
Eli yoshev al hakisei yad derech mitzapeh. And he was sitting upon his throne or his seat. He was waiting by the watchman. And his heart was trembling for the ark. And he came into the city and he told the city what was going on. And the city started to call out, right? Started to cry, right? 30,000 people died. The ark was taken captured. Right? This is a major calamity. Eli heard the noise. What's the tumult? So they brought them. He didn't want to go to Eli, I guess. He didn't want to report to Eli. The news was too terrible to bear. So he came to tell Eli. And Eli was 98 years old. He was no youngster. He was he couldn't see, so he actually didn't see what the man looked like because he was blind. So the man reported, and he said the following. Anochi haba min ha-maracha. I have come to from the battlefield. Vani min ha-maracha nasti hayom. And I have fled from the battlefield. So vayomer me'aya davar b'ni. So Eli says to him, how did it go? Vaya'an ha-mevaser. So now I have a description of this person's role. This person's role is the Mivaser, just like the story of Achimatz. Vasrei wants to be the Mivaser. And Yoav says to him, Lo tevaser, you're not going to be the Mivaser today. Somebody else will be the Mivaser. But the Mivaser was a person who reported from the front. In that particular case, the news was not good. The Israelites were fleeing before the Plishtim. And there was a terrible plague amongst the people. And your two sons, Chofni Pinchas, died. And the ark has been taken captive, has been taken by the Plishtim. Okay, in that particular moment, when Eli heard the ark was taken, captured by the Plishtim, Vayipol mi'al ha-kiseh ha-choranit, he fell backwards off his chair, ba'ad yad ha-sha'ar, which was sitting by the gate.
So he spoke to
him, right? Yeah. And he broke his neck and he died. So there's a lot to unpack in that story. That's not our subject for today, but the Mivaser clearly asked the question. Sorry, I'm just running out of background noise. I'm just going to mute, but if you want to participate, just unmute, because the person who brought these tidings is called the Mivaser. In this particular case, it was not a good report. So we would call that a Mivaser Ra, right? He's telling a bad report, but he's still, that's his job, that's his function. If I go forward a little bit, let's go to Shmuel Bet, also Perek Daled. That's just coincidence. We get to another story of a Mivaser. This one is reporting to David. Now we're getting a little closer to home. And if you remember, the beginning of Sefer Shmuel Bet starts with the death of Shaul and his sons on the battlefield with our old nemesis, the Plishtim. And that's the end of chapter of Shmuel Aleph. Shmuel Bet opens with David mourning, lamenting for the death of Shaul. Actually, let me just see. I'll try to do this very quickly. Let me just see quickly if. Come on. We'll do it here. It'll be easier to see. After the fall of Shaul and the fall of Shaul and his sons, there is another. David sets himself up as king in Hebron. Remember the right beginning of Shmuel Bet. And then there is a surviving son of Shaul by the name of Ishbosheth. Surviving son of Shaul by the name of Ishbosheth becomes the competitor to David. So he becomes anointed as king over the northern kingdom of, well, at that time, the northern kingdom from Binyamin on north. And Avner becomes his general. He set up his first, he's crowned king, he's anointed king in what city? Where does his kingdom begin? And they go, and where does Avner ben Ner, Sar Tzva Shel Shaul, Avner ben Ner goes and he takes Ishbosheth ben Shaul and he makes him king. Where does he start his kingdom? Vayavireu?
I am.
Machanaim. So I said, Machanaim is a major center. All the, it's a start of Machut Shaul, of Ishbosheth ben Shaul starts in Machanaim. David goes to Machanaim to fight against Avshalom. Right? There's a lot of parallels there, but that's, and from there his kingdom expands into the Gilad, which is the north of Ever Yarden, and then to the area of Ashur and Yisrael and Ephraim and Benjamin and Yisrael. And I have two kingdoms, and they're at war with each other. And Avner is the general of Shaul, and Yoav is the general of David, and these two armies are at war with each other for a very significant period of time, 7 years. And finally, Vatiya Mechama Aruka ben Beit Shaul ben Beit David. And we have, finally, I'm not going to get into all the details. Eventually, they will unite the two kingdoms together. In the meantime, this war will end, as we know it to be, when Ishbosheth is no longer a threat to David. Well, no longer perceived as a threat to David. So we have the following story. We have these two people from Gat. And Yonatan ben Shaul ben Nechenaglayim ben Chameshanim. Let's skip all of this. Sons of Rimona Beroti, Rechavan Ba'ana come, the two Givonim, remnants of the tribe of the Givonim that had that Shaul had gone to war with. They came in the middle of the night to in the middle of the day, into the house of Ishbosheth, Ishbosheth, son of Shaul. And Ishbosheth was sleeping. It's afternoon siesta. He's taking a nap. They came into the house in stealth. Come into the house. He's lying on his bed. And they killed him. They killed Ishbosheth. You kill Ishbosheth, the war is over. Right? You kill the king, the war is over. The rebellion is done. Now you can unite the kingdom. And they took off his head. They took his head and they left in the middle of the night. Where did they go? Where were they bringing his head to? David. Because they figured David will embrace them and reward them for the news that Ishbosheth was dead and that they could continue. So they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David in Hebron. Vayamru al HaMelech, they said to the king. Talk about reading the tea leaves wrong, right? They said to the king, Hinei rosh Ishbosheth ben Shaul oyevecha. Here is the head of Ishbosheth, your enemy. Shebikesh et nafshecha, who wanted to kill you. Vayiten Hashem ladonin HaMelech nekamot hayom hazeh mishaul umizaro. God has now avenged you of Shaul and of his seed. David's reaction. Bayan David et rechaved ba'ana achiv. So he turns to these two people and he says, B'nei Rimona be'otim v'yom alehem. Chai Hashem asher padat nafshi mikol tzva. I take an oath as God lives. God redeemed me from all my adversity. And now he tells these two guys a story. What's the story he tells them? Once upon a time, somebody came to give me news about the death of a king. And this is actually a story that's referenced in Tanakh. I was looking for it before. We'll skip it now. But the person who came to tell me that Shaul was dead, he was not doing nothing more than reporting what he saw. Right? He came to Mivaser. He came to report that he saw Shaul die. Now, it's a little bit more complicated than that, because that was where the Shaul had fallen on his sword, if you remember. And Shaul turned to his servant and he said to him, you know what, I fell on my sword to take my own life. Unsuccessfully, he's still alive. So he asks his servant to finish the task. He doesn't want to fall into the hands of the Plishtim. And so he does so at Shaul's request. And David hears this and he kills this Eved for the audacity for having raised his hand against the king. But that's a part of the story. He was just the one to report to me. I took him and I killed him in Ziklag. Just for giving me this report. There's that word again. But you, wicked men, you took a righteous, innocent person and you killed him on his bed in the middle of the day while he was sleeping. You don't think I'm going to take his blood? I'm going to avenge his blood from you? And so these two guys do not live to walk out the door. That's the second part of that story. So to the second time, it's actually the third, but he references it here, right? To bring a report to the king means to tell him what's going on. Now, in these two instances, there happened to be a report about the death of his enemy, but his enemy was the other king, right? Shaul or Ishbosheth, and in both cases, he has them killed. I don't know, if I was in that position, I'm not sure I would want to be the one to run to David to report to him of the death of his son. Considering that when his real enemy, in this case Ishbosheth or Shaul, the person who reported to him didn't live to tell the time of day, suddenly they all want to run to be the mivaser to the melech to tell him that Avshalom is dead. It's a moment, that's a pause. That's a stop moment to think about and to consider. One additional piece that I just want to share with you very briefly, and then we will end for today, and that is that this role of the mivaser to the king takes on a life of its own, and it actually now becomes identified as the role of the one who will bring the news about the victory. Now, if the news about the victory is good, right, or the news about the battle is good, then great. The news about the battle is bad, it's mivaser ra. But what if the news is about the battle that is eschatological, that is end of time kind of battle, that is the story of Melech HaMashiach, that is the right? So whoever brings that news is talking about the news of the redemption, right? So that brings us to the other two places where the word Mivaser comes to a particular powerful meaning, and that is in Sefer Yeshayahu. Yeshayahu in two places uses the expression. One is in Perek Mem Aleph, at the end of the Perek, where he talks about people who will come back to the land of Israel, the first ones to return, Rishon Litzion Hinam, the first ones to return to Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim Mivaser Eten. I will make them the harbinger. I will make them the one to tell the story, to reflect the anticipation of that redemption. Okay, hence the phrase Rishon Litzion, which has become the title for the Sephardic chief rabbi in Israel today. That's one reference. The other, which is even more powerful, is in Yeshayahu Nunbet, part of the Haftarot, of the seven Haftarot of comfort that we read during the between Tisha B'Av and Rosh Hashanah. And there we find the following psukim. Uri Uri Lifshi Uzech Tzion, awake, awake, put on your strength, Tzion. Lifshi Bigdei Tifatech, Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh, put on your garments of beauty, Yerushalayim, holy city. You will no longer have Tumah come to you, Hitnavi Me'afar Kumi, get up from the dust of the earth, Shvi Yerushalayim, resettle, resit, and develop, and Hitpatri, Mosvei Tzavarech, loosen your bands, expand. The people of Tzion will come back to your gates. Kikom Hashem, you will be redeemed. There's a lot of references here. I'm going to skip most of them, and then we come to the following verse. Lachen yeda ami shmi lachem beyom ahu ki ani hu amedaber hineni. My people shall know my name. I speak on that day. Ma navu al harim. How beautiful upon the mountains are raglei mivaser, the feet of the messenger, the feet of the one who brings the message. What message? Mashmiya shalom, brings the harbinger, the message of peace. Mashmiya tov, mivaser tov, he comes to bring a message of good. Mashmiya yeshua, he comes to bring the message of redemption. So in one phrase, mivaser, Raglei Mivaser, the feet of the one who brings the news, the one who brings the tidings, Mashmiya Shalom, Mivaser Tov, Mashmiya Yeshua, Omer L'Tzion, Malach L'Kayach, who says to Tzion, your God reigns. And everybody sings out, right, called Sofayach, the watchman, raises his voice. Nasu Kol Yachdav Yoranenu, they sing together, Ki Ayin B'Ayin Yeru B'Shuv Hashem Tzion, seeing as God returns to Tzion. And the rest of the Haftarah as well, Necham Hashem Amo, Ga'al Yerushalayim, God has redeemed his people, redeemed and redeemed Yerushalayim. But the notion that the Mivaser is the one to bring the harbinger of the message of redemption, right, that has sort of a term that has now become borrowed from all of these references in Sefer Shmuel of the one who brings the tidings of the result of the war. In some instances, the Mivaser of the Churban, in the case of Shiloh. In other instances, the Mavaser who told of the death of the king or the end of the war with the enemy, in the case of Shaul, Ishbosheth, or Avshalom. And the language of Yeshayahu, this is the term used for the person who brings the message about the redemption of Israel. Mashmiya Shalom Mavaser Tov, Mashmiya Yeshua, Kol Mavaser, the voice of the harbinger, the one who will come to tell us that the redemption is on its way, a role that has been typically assigned to Eliyahu HaNavi, but conceptually, but this is the text of the notion of Kol Mivaser, Ma Navu Alarim Raglei Mivaser. So we took us on a journey today. We went into all kinds of other places. Understand the role of a Mivaser, we understood the role of the gates and the Tzofer and all of the different personalities involved in the story. And kind of all the background to this parak, which I thought would be just a good exercise to go through. Next week, we're going to come back to the text. And come back to the core question in this text, which is, what's going on? What does the Chimatz want to do? What does the Yoav want to do? What is David looking for? Why is there such a conversation about who gets to or has to be the Mivaser in this story, right? That's, to use the language that we just established, why is it so important to identify who the Mivaser is going to be? Why is that almost more important than the message itself? Is the question of who gets to bring that message. That's the question we need to address.
Well, can I just say one thing? That David did ask those guys to be Mivaserim, right? Like he asked, the priest's sons, right? At one point, he told them that they could come and tell him the news about things. So maybe he was trying to do his job.
But in a different arena, that was more about being like, almost like a spy for him as he was going into exile before he turned to reclaim his throne in the fight with Avshalom. So I don't know if that role would have continued. In all cases, he would have had to have gone through Yoav, and maybe that's what he wanted to do, Achimatz. He wanted to be that role, But Yoav stops him. And what I'm really looking for is trying to understand Yoav. Why does Yoav put a brake on Achimaatz? And there's a complexity there that we'll explore. We'll explain
about it. His lineage, that where he's going to. Anyway, okay.
Yeah, we'll get to it. We have to put a few more variables on the table for it to happen. Okay, very good.
Thank you, Rabbi.